This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Running for Congress as a Democrat in the 13th District seems like a popular thing to do just now.
I am running for Congress because I think a lot of people out there, see that government is not working for the people.
Hear from Jonathan Ebel, the fifth Democratic candidate seeking to run against Republican Rodney Davis next year. GLT's Ryan Denham has the interview. College students are back in town, and that means more business for Uber and Lyft drivers. Find out what it's like to give rides to strangers. And it's a conversation with Samantha Fish. She's known for her fierce blues guitar playing, but shows off a different side on her new album. She's playing the Castle Theater tomorrow. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 28th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A fifth Democrat is formally announcing his plans to run for the 13th congressional district in the March primary. Jonathan Ebel is from Urbana. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Ebel about how he'll mount a viable challenge to Republican incumbent Rodney Davis and why he's making his first run at elected office.
I am running for Congress because I think a lot of people out there, see that government is not working for the people. And part of the problem, a large part of the problem, I think, is that we have too many people in elected office who are not there for the right reasons. They're serving the interests of large corporations and large donors, whose interests necessarily are different from those of common people. And I saw a need, and that need is for people with a good moral compass and a good head on their shoulders and no connections like the ones that are warping politics to get involved. I think I speak for a lot of people right now, but that's really what we need.
So you're a professor at University of Illinois.
Yes, I am.
So what do you teach, and how long have you been there?
I teach in the Department of Religion. I've been here for 12 years, and my courses are usually about the religious history of the United States. That's my specialization. But I also teach regularly our survey of world religion, which is one of the more popular courses on campus.
What are the issues that are most important to you?
Well, again, like a lot of people, I'm very concerned about the state of healthcare in the United States. It's just a fact of life that we are all going to need doctors, that we and those around us are all going to need medical care at some time. So it strikes me as well past time that we go about getting universal health care. And I think the best way to do that is through a single payer system. Not a single provider system, but a single payer system.
But how should people kind of think of you when it comes to the political spectrum, left,
well,
right, center, all that?
I identify strongly with many kinds of progressive issues, but they strike me as really centrally American issues, and I'm a person of faith. Issues that are connected to you know, many of the best sentiments of the world's religious traditions. So, you know, we embrace diversity. We're skeptical of entrenched interests and power, and we do everything that we can to help people in need. To heal the sick, to care for the widow and the orphan, to lift up those who are downtrodden, and those are the things that animate me, and they're values that I think I share with a lot of people. You look at the history of the United States, and its best moments are those in which those have been the principles that drive people. And I think we're in a moment right now where where those principles have come into question, but I don't doubt that they'll prevail. I really don't. We need to work hard and elect the right people who will stand up for those principles. But I do believe that the arc of history bends toward justice and toward progress.
So this is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm here with Jonathan Ebel, a professor at the University of Illinois, who is running for the 13th Congressional District as a Democrat. He's now the fifth candidate to announce plans to challenge Republican Rodney Davis in next year's election. All right, John, so the 13th Congressional District is sprawling, right? It includes parts or all of 14 different counties, stretching all the way to Edwardsville, also southwest parts of Bloomington-Normal and where you live out near Champaign-Urbana. Some of these areas are pretty rural, Republican-leaning areas. So how could a Democrat like you win in a district like this?
I have a couple of answers to that question. The first is that I think what people expressed in 2016 and have been for a longer time expressing about the politics in general is that people aren't listening, and that government responds has been responding to the interests of coastal America. I am a listener in my professional work and in my personal life. I like to go and find voices that aren't being heard and listen to them and take them seriously. As I think about this district, I think reaching out to rural America, hearing their concerns, which are all of our concerns, and working on behalf of rural communities, revitalizing these wonderful small towns, bringing people back into the political process, are just kind of widely appealing ideas. So I think that is something that I can do well. I'm also a veteran, and I know that these rural communities, and there are lots of people in the service from the 13th district. I know about their experiences. I've lived many of them. I've been mobilized from a reserve status. I've deployed on active duty. I know the strains that puts on a family, and I think that in this district there are people who would be willing to vote for someone who's shared that experience and knows how hard it can be.
What branch of the service were you in?
I was in the Navy. I had an ROTC scholarship to go to college, and I spent 4 years on active duty as a naval intelligence officer, and then another 7 years in the reserves doing that same thing.
So as the Champaign News Gazette reported when you, first filed your paperwork to run, that you're the only candidate currently on the Democratic side from Champaign County.
Mm-hmm.
And the News Gazette points out that that's a pretty important part of the district when it comes to especially the Democratic primary. How do you think that'll play out? How do you think that'll affect your chances of potentially winning the primary and maybe the general, being from where you're from?
I've lived here long enough to know that Champaign-Urbana is full of really independent-minded people, and we don't have any reflexive voters here when it comes to primaries. And so my strategy here and throughout the district is going to be to get out and meet people, introduce myself, show people that I care, that I really want to do the hard work, often unglamorous work, of being their congressman, that I want to get out of bed every single day and try to make the world a better place for them and for those they love. And I think that's a message that will resonate here in Champaign-Urbana, and it will resonate in Edwardsville and Springfield and Bloomington-Normal and all of the many places in between. At the end of the day, I think people in this district just want someone who's going to work for them, and sadly, Rodney Davis stopped doing that long ago.
This is going to be potentially a pretty costly campaign, right? So it's going to attract money from the National Republican Congressional Committee as well as the Democratic side. How much money do you think it's going to take to mount a viable challenge to Congressman Davis, and how will you do that?
Well, first, I would like to remind your listeners of the story of David and Goliath, right? And the fact that it's not always the biggest warrior who wins the fight. I will... You know, again, do the hard work that politicians at all levels have to do, and that's get on the phone and ask people who care about this district, who care about this country, to support me. I have a nice network of friends nationally who've indicated that they're willing to support, but really the support that matters most is the support that comes from within the 13th district. And I'm going to work my tail off to bring that in. So that's, you know, as someone who's doing this for the first time, I'm pretty clear-eyed, I think, about how hard that is, and also what it is that we're up against. It's, you know, very, very, very deep pockets on the other side. We aren't going to be able to outraise them, but we can outsmart and out-hustle them, and that's what I plan to do.
Since you're potentially running against Rodney Davis here, I assume you have some concerns about how he's represented the district in Congress. Where do you think he's most vulnerable?
Well, there's the issue of health care, which he came down really firmly on the side of repealing health care, taking health care, health insurance away from, you know, in the neighborhood of 30 million Americans. And if that's not a vulnerability, I don't know what is. That to me is a morally reprehensible position to stake out. And then there's the question of style, where Rodney Davis has not wanted to stand up and have the courage of his convictions to defend his votes, to discuss with the people for whom he works what it is that he's doing. And so I think that as a policy issue, healthcare, and as a style issue, accessibility and just the embrace of democracy are some things that he hasn't ever done well.
GLT's Ryan Denham with Jonathan Ebel, a professor from Urbana who's running for the 13th Congressional District as a Democrat. The other candidates who've announced plans to run on the Democratic side include Betsy Londrigan, David Gill, Brian Webb, and Eric Jones. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. College students are back. Coffee shops, bars, and buses are busy, along with Uber and Lyft drivers. Coming up during Sound Ideas, you'll hear from a few of those drivers. I'm Mike McCurdy. Details have not been released yet in the school funding bill compromise, but the Illinois Politics Roundtable is talking about the general shape of the bipartisan deal. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the discussion with Charlie Weaver of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Amanda Vinicky, the political reporter for WTTW Television, and WBEZ politics reporter Tony Arnold.
At least in concept, the news of this week is there. You know, House Speaker Michael Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton came to an agreement with the House Republican and Senate Republican leaders, which is notable as of considering where we've been in the last 2.5 years since Governor Rauner took over.
Not only the Republican leaders, but also this appears to have signed off on by Governor Bruce Rauner. And he is truly the linchpin of all of this, I would think, because he needs to sign it into law. If it has his blessing, you'll have Republican legislators perhaps more free to vote for it. That sort of gets it going because he, of course, was the one who used his mandatory veto power on the major education funding measure and has been really sort of the catalyst here. However you want to look at it, if it has his blessing, that is a big deal, and you could take that as in a sense, a win for Governor Bruce Rauner, although there most certainly is pushback. As Tony noted, of course, we always say it, true, devil's in the details, and we haven't truly seen those details yet, and there's also the matter of convincing legislators to actually vote for this, because there has been such heated rhetoric surrounding education funding and the notion that it is a bailout for Chicago public schools. What we do know in limited fashion is that Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is really happy about this and says CPS will get what it was set to receive under the original plan, Senate Bill 1, and more. So how do downstate legislators, how does the governor reconcile that? Apparently also part of this deal is a tax credit program that would allow people to give to a fund that will be used for scholarships for private and parochial schools, and in exchange, donors, be it businesses or individuals who want to give that money, will receive 75 cents for every dollar that they give in a tax credit.
Well, let's go back to the original legislation. And Amanda, you pointed out what the governor's concern had with it, and that was that it was what he called a bailout for Chicago. The original legislation that really did change the funding formula for the state. It was aimed at helping poorer downstate schools. Nobody's saying that part has been changed in any way, in the sense that some of these downstate schools would be in line, at least eventually, for more money. It's just how Chicago's going to get some dollars out of this and maybe this other program, or have we heard anything else?
You know, what we've heard is very limited. I did speak with a source who had been apprised of the details and said that pretty much it jives with the intent of Senate Bill 1, the original legislation. So make of that what you will. That was really all I could tease out. But you have had, of course, discussion about mandates and whether schools would be lifted if from the requirements the state puts on them. That is something Republicans had wanted to be more streamlined, either getting rid of some or streamlining the process for districts being able to say, we want to get out of that. We don't know what the final detail is, but apparently there's something to that effect is going to be part of this deal, but I've heard it is somewhat limited. And that is why, again, this is getting some pushback already. You're having unions, of course, upset about what they're phrasing in terms of this private school scholarship as a voucher program. It isn't per se exactly a voucher program, but that's what they say it is. You know, walks like a duck, talks like a duck sort of thing. And then also, for example, one Republican who's often out in front on things, that's David McSweeney, he says that it is total capitulation by the governor, and it appears like CPS could get more money, as we've already talked about, and that there isn't, it seems, anything that Republicans and the governor had been asking for in terms of allowing private contracting that would cut schools' costs. Republicans say that is currently something Chicago has been able to do since 1995, but not any other district. Not a surprise that that's not part of it. The last press conference that House Speaker Michael Madigan had in Springfield, he said, I'm not open to that. I don't want to do it. But that apparently is also not part of the deal.
Charlie, are you surprised, I guess, first of all, that they're able to reach a deal? I think everybody assumed they would try to get something done for schools, but it sure sounds like there are a lot of loose ends here and maybe a lot for people to dislike when these details come out.
My advice to everyone would be, yeah, there's going to be parts that you don't like, but what's the alternative? And I'll go back to what I said when Governor Rauner first decided he didn't like the school reform overhaul contained in Senate Bill 1, and his education aide said, well, he likes 90% of it, but he's going to veto it because of the other 10%. And at the time, I said that most political leaders in my time would be happy to get 90% of what they wanted. And now I'll flip it. If there's money in there for Chicago schools, if this idea of penalizing schools that are under tax caps and saying, we'll pretend that you can actually access the money from those properties when you can't, if that's not in there, if the collective bargaining changes that were imposed on the Chicago public schools by the Republicans in 1995, if they're not extended statewide, there's, you know, I would say to the unions, accept the $75 million that's going to go to private schools. You got a lot of other stuff and you avoided a lot of other damage. So be happy. And I think the pressure on both sides, now there'll be critics who vote against it for one reason or another. It doesn't hurt the unions enough, or it's too favorable to private schools. But the majority of the lawmakers, I think, would be happy to vote for something that will start sending money to the local schools, because the reaction that you're getting from school superintendents, even parents around the state, is, hey, we have to do something or we're not going to be able to operate our schools.
Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield was joined on the Illinois Politics Roundtable by Amanda Vinicky, Tony Arnold, and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal bars and restaurants aren't the only ones happy that the college students are back in town. Local Uber and Lyft drivers rely on those students for their income, usually late-night rides after a night of drinking. GLT's Ryan Denham talked with local Uber and Lyft drivers about what it's like to give rides to strangers.
Mike Quinn from Normal works a full-time job at Country Financial, but on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, he's a regular on the local bar scene. He's a part-time Uber and Lyft driver, and those drunk riders are his top clientele. He's been driving with Uber for a couple of years, and recently added Lyft, too. He keeps both apps open until he gets a ride. Quinn, who has a new baby at home, says it's been a great part-time job.
I just wanted to make some extra money. It was a really, easy way to make money. I'd just basically sit in my car and drive from point to point. I don't have to get out of the car. I don't have to sit at a desk. I don't have to report to anybody. And when I don't want to work, I don't work. And when I want to work, I just open the app and work.
So is that kind of what made it a little more attractive than other part-time gigs you could do? I mean, delivering pizzas or what have you?
For sure. And the flexibility is really their drawing point, is that if you don't want to drive, then you don't have to. And there's nobody that's going to tell you you have to.
Initially just a big city amenity, Uber and Lyft are now regular features in the Bloomington Normal transportation economy. Uber has been operating locally since 2015, and its top competitor, Lyft, started serving the area earlier this year. While there are local riders who are not so tipsy, like corporate clients and people going to the mechanic, on the weekend it's mostly drunk college students.
It depends on what's going on. Say there's a football game, in the afternoon, then it can be really busy during the football game time or before and after the game. And then usually from about 8 o'clock until the bars close, I'm driving up and down Main Street from campus to Bloomington and then back the other way once the bars close.
A recent large survey by the blog and podcast The Rideshare Guy revealed some interesting statistics about Uber and Lyft and its drivers. Those drivers are contractors, and for Uber, they make, on average, $15.68 an hour. Lyft drivers make $2 more on average. Most drivers are older. More than three-quarters are older than age 40. There are around 350 Uber drivers locally, according to City of Bloomington records. It's unclear how many Lyft has. Uber and Lyft, by the way, did not return a request for comment on this story. Most drivers are doing it for the extra money, but not everyone. Local driver Matt Gray drives for his full-time job, at least until his other career as a musician really takes off. He's been driving for Uber around 9 months and Lyft for 3 weeks. He drives about 6 days a week, and for a guy who likes talking to people, it's a perfect fit.
Well, it is a lot of fun. I get to talk to a variety of different people, from corporate people who are coming into town, to students, to just about anybody who will get in the car and set up a ride.
I gotta ask, is it weird, like having strangers getting into your car?
It was at first, and I had this hesitation before I even started it. I was like, so what kind of problems am I gonna see? And after a while, what I noticed was that everybody just needs to get where they need to go. And it turned out okay. So it isn't weird at all to me at this point.
How often do you drive on a weekly basis?
I drive regularly. I try to get out every day. if not, you know, 6 days a week at least.
Are you usually doing the same time of day, or does it kind of bounce around week to week?
What I had been doing this past summer is working mainly days, and then now that the students are back, I'm going to be working as like days during the week and then nights on the weekends, which are quite lucrative.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I wondered how the flow of things changed when college students were in town versus out of town.
When the students aren't here, there is still business on a more local and corporate basis. You know, people getting to and from work, or locals going to the bars and such. When the students are here, it's just really, really used a lot.
Gray doesn't even mind making small talk with drunk college students because what they're really doing to him is not getting behind the wheel while intoxicated.
From a personal standpoint and motivation, I had a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, who was killed in a drunk driver accident. He wasn't driving drunk. He was hit by a drunk driver in the morning. And so for me, every time that I get out there, especially at night and getting the students around, I think about that, and I think that I'm hoping that I help in some way, shape, or form to get these kids home safely.
Not every ride involves the bars. For Mike Quinn, the part-time driver, one of his most memorable rides was long distance.
I did have a ride from Bloomington to Chicago one night, like at 1 in the morning. A gentleman in Chicago asked for an Uber in Bloomington because his girlfriend was here and he wanted her to come up, and so he ordered an Uber from Bloomington to downtown Chicago. It cost him about $250, and I made about $180 or so out of that. So,
and what happens when you get there? You just turn right back around?
Yeah, I just turned around and drove home by myself in the middle of the night. So, but it's, you know, I still made $180 driving to Chicago and back, which not many people can say they do.
Not everyone is happy to see Uber and Lyft grow their footprint here in Bloomington Normal. Aaron Halliday is owner of Checker Cab in Bloomington. A couple of years ago, he had a few dozen vehicles on the road each weekend, but now with Uber and Lyft grabbing so much of his business, he's cut a few drivers from each shift every day.
Let's just say Uber/Lyft has probably taken about 20% of my business away from me. Some of that's good, some of it's bad. It's bad because of the bottom line, but it's made me run a more lean operation. I don't have those 15 cars sitting in the parking lot during the week that I was paying insurance on not being used. So my insurance went down, obviously. We are in the process of changing dispatch software program to where we will have our own branded app that will allow, basically has the same features as Uber has. So that's something that is new. We hope to have that next month.
And that's not all Halliday is doing to adapt to changing times. He recently installed a podcast studio, and this fall will be launching the taxi industry's first trade podcast. The plan is to sell sponsorships on his podcast and a related website to supplement his income, the income he's lost to Uber and Lyft. The city of Bloomington is responsible for regulating transportation network companies, or TNCs, like Uber and Lyft for itself and the town of Normal next door. Halliday says the city has tried to make it as level a playing field as possible, though Uber has more money to try to influence policymakers. George Boyle with the city's legal department explains the difference between how taxi cabs are regulated versus Uber and Lyft.
With regard to the taxis, there, the city is a little bit more hands-on in terms of the regulation of the drivers, in terms of we license the drivers specifically, as opposed to just the company hiring the driver. And we look more into the background checks and do a little bit more hands-on inspections of the vehicles. In the case of the transportation network companies, they do a lot of those functions, and our regulation is more of them, of the companies themselves, to have a regulatory framework to see if those things are being done.
Rules and regulations aside, full-time driver Matt Gray has become sort of like a bartender, an expert on the job conversationalist. But instead of getting them drunk, he's getting them home safe.
I really like to talk with the riders. You know, I like to find out what they're up to. You know, if they're students, I like to ask, you know, what are you studying? What are your goals? You know, that kind of thing. And it's a really fun conversation. I think they really enjoy the conversation. It's almost like interviewing people every day, you know. I do like talking with people. It's just my general mindset of interest in others and what they like to do and where they're headed.
I'm Ryan Denham.
According to that survey from the Rideshare Guy podcast, most drivers sign up with Uber and Lyft to make extra money. The other top reasons: they need a more flexible job, got fired or laid off from their last job, or just want to try it out or pass the time. It's Sound Ideas. Movie Drive, a real hero from the band College featuring Electric Youth on Sound Ideas. If you bring the bike, we'll bring the light. Every bike you bring to the 5th annual Light the Night event in Uptown Normal September 7th gets a free front and rear light. Bring the bike and we'll bring the light. While there, get a bike safety check and get freebies from Connect Transit for trying a bus bike rack. GLT, Good to Go, Connect Transit, Bike Blono, and the Town of Normal are partnering for Light the Night September 7th. Find details at wglt.org/goodtogo.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This Thursday marks the 20th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana, a woman who made a lasting impression on the royal family and an even bigger impact on our culture. Laura Kennedy has more.
In 1981, a 20-year-old young woman walked down the aisle of St. Paul's Cathedral to be wed to the Prince of Wales. Although their marriage didn't work, the public's love affair with Princess Diana never abated, even after her tragic death 20 years ago. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven, says our enduring fascination with Diana relates to our fascination with real-life fairy tales.
People were interested in the dream of this woman being plucked more or less from obscurity into being royalty.
Well, she passed away. She was killed 20 years ago, and right. We still have our fascination with her. Why has that not abated over the last 20 years?
Well, I think she was, in and of herself, a compelling figure. She lived this very high-profile life, the ups and downs of her marriage, all that sort of thing. She befriended lots of celebrities, or they befriended her. So she was a princess who herself joined the royal family with other kinds of royalty, but she also very much was a humanitarian. She was one of the first public figures to hold little babies who had AIDS and brought incredible money and attention to the AIDS crisis, particularly in Africa, which we continue to struggle with how to address that as a world, and did lots and lots of very active charity work, not just lending her name to things, but lending her face and her presence.
Well, speaking of her extensive humanitarian work, did she blaze that trail for other celebrities to follow? I mean, because certainly you had people like Audrey Hepburn, who was working for UNICEF and so forth, but this just seemed to be taking it to a whole new level.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say she blazed a trail. She was certainly part of a moment in time when Bob Geldof was doing his bit to bring lots of celebrities together in a very, very big way to address world problems. The 80s were rife with Farm Aid and different kind of big name events. The trailblazer in all that stuff was really Jerry Lewis. And so anybody after Jerry Lewis's work with muscular dystrophy is on the tail end of that kind of work. Now, in terms of royalty, I am not a royalty scholar. I know that the British royalty have always lent their names to things, but the degree to which they were actively involved I can't say for sure whether she was ahead of the game in that or not. Certainly in my lifetime, relative to contemporaneous figures, she was.
So, Sherry, do you think that Diana changed the notion of what a princess could be?
Yes, because even though you're absolutely right, she was not a commoner, as it were, but she had this connection to people who were suffering, people who were not advantaged, that there was this shyness about her that made a lot of people feel, and when I say a lot of people, I mean millions,
yes,
feel as if she was one of them, as if she did have knowledge of what it was like to read a regular, perhaps difficult life.
Well, certainly Princess Diana was famous, but was she important?
Yes, there's no doubt that she was important. She wasn't a lawmaker, right? But the attention that she brought, in particular to the AIDS crisis in Africa, probably saved millions of lives. The name that she gave and the time that she gave and the celebrities she brought to raise money for countless other charities probably saved lives. I mean, can one draw a direct line? Possibly not. But that level of interest and commitment certainly did a lot of good in the world. And she seems to have passed that on to her sons, who were very young when she died. But it looks like her eldest son is going to carry on some of that. She made, in some way, she made the royal family relevant again. Politically, in terms of the running of England, they are not particularly relevant. They are a relic of a long ago past. And of course, there are many folks who believe that the monarchy should be done away with. But specifically making the monarchy active in identifying the problems of the world, not just flying the British flag around the world, but in the problems of the world, in addressing the problems of the world, in bringing people together to address the problems of the world, she made the monarchy, to some degree, meaningful again.
Sherry, what do you think was Diana's appeal? What was at that core? Was it her vulnerability?
Well, folks love that, right? It's why we loved Edith Piaf and why we love Judy Garland and a whole lot of people. We tend to romanticize the tragic side of people. I think to some extent then her death has only ensured her place in the cultural imagination as if it weren't already assured. But that sort of self-effacing, shy way she dealt with her fame. Now, it's weird to say self-effacing just a few breaths after I've talked about how she used her celebrity to do so much good, but there was always a gentleness and a shyness about her that I think very much played into people's ideas that she herself needed some kind of protection, or that she herself was perhaps more vulnerable than she really was, but it gave people an in to her life and to her character in terms of their identification with her.
Do you think that perhaps she has been turned into a victim, that we view her since she died so young and you know, her marriage fell apart and she was pursued by the media and so forth? Did that turn her into a victim? And if so, how does this impact her legacy?
Yeah, I think she will always be seen to some degree as someone who was killed by fame, who was a victim of her own fame. But isn't that a funny thing, right? It was the public's demand, insatiable demand for information of her, pictures of her, that fed the media who pursued her and led directly to her accident 20 years ago. I think, yes, she will always be in that category of victim or tragic loss. She's in that category of a life cut short. And let's not forget, Elton John has done his bit to solidify our cultural understanding of her in terms of victimhood, in terms of, with his song about her, in terms of victimhood and loss and fragility and all those kinds of things.
The song that he wrote about Marilyn Monroe, but he turned into a song about Diana at
exactly,
her funeral.
At her funeral, right.
Goodbye, blooms rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You are the grace that placed yourselves where lives were torn apart. You called out to our country, and you whispered to those in pain, now you belong to heaven, and the stars spell out your name. it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in.
Well, you mentioned the paparazzi and her death. She, you know, of course, throughout her life as a royal and afterwards, she was pursued by the paparazzi. There was that hunger for the photographs. They were going for the photographs, and the paparazzi was pursuing her up to the very last moment. Do they remain persona non grata with us? Do we have a different view of the paparazzi now?
We might have a different view of them, but we still have the same insatiable demand for what they get for us to consume. So that, I mean, that's part of the split. It's, you know, I liken it to the fact that I am not a vegetarian, but I can't stand the thought of a cow being killed. So we culturally recognize the paparazzi as horrible, horrible people. But hey, get me those photos. I can't wait to see the pictures of George Clooney's twins, right? We despise them, but we still buy what they produce.
You know, here it is, the 20th anniversary of her death, and there are specials galore and articles on the internet all over the place, and we're all talking about her. But is she going to continue to be this kind of famous past this anniversary? Have we elevated her to icon status so that generations who never knew her when she was alive admire her?
That's a really tough one. I would say in the same way that we have and have not Judy Garland. So if you ask most people in their 20s now to name the greatest stars of all time, Judy Garland is not going to likely be on that list. There's not a great craving for information about her among that set. Might she be known, however, vaguely to them? Possibly, but possibly not. I expect Diana to fall into that category. However, as people get older, or if you continue to look at people my age and a little bit younger and a little older, I think Diana will still resonate. And also, it sort of depends on what her sons do and to what degree they make their marks on the world, if they have a similar kind of, or even not just similar, but anything approaching the kind of impact on the public consciousness that she had, that will also feed into the longevity of her icon status. Yeah.
That's GLT's culture maven, Sherry Zeck. She's the interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University. I'm Laura Kennedy.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Elton John's reworking of Candle in the Wind, played at Princess Diana's funeral. It's Sound Ideas.
Hold out to our country, and you whispered to those in pain, now you belong to heaven, and the stars spell out your name.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Samantha Fish is known for her fierce blues guitar playing, but on her new album, she said she wanted to showcase a different side. Fish plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington tomorrow night. She took a few minutes out of her current tour to talk with GLT's John Norton about the curveball she threw at longtime fans.
Wow.
The song is Chills and Fever. It's the title track to the latest release by Samantha Fish. It's a song that Tom Jones recorded at one point, but for this album, Fish said she took the original version, the one by Ronnie Love.
You know, it had a great hook and a great melody, and there was something special about it. So, you know, the whole record, Chills and Fever, is comprised of covers from the 50s and 60s. Everything we picked, we wanted, you know, these obscure classics, which, you know, I feel like Chills and Fever, that Ronnie Love song, fit the bill.
Well, the whole album is a bit of a curveball for someone known as a blues artist and has a reputation as sort of a guitar slinger. Was it freeing for you to be able to go in this direction?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, since the start of my career, I think everybody, you know, when you play music, it's not like you know, this is the way my band is going to be forever. You know, like I didn't always want to be doing the trio thing, but you kind of start there. You know, for me, that's where I started. You know, it was just the right time to kind of expand and add these other layers. Every time I write, I hear, you know, different dynamic things I could add, whether it's like a pedal steel or a horn line or, you know, piano part. You know, now is the opportunity to get to spread out and do those things.
the direction you took with this album, is this something you've been wanting to do for a while? Is this a kind of sound you grew up with, maybe with a record collection from somebody? Or why in this direction?
Well, my favorite singers are, when I started playing music, were soul singers. And kind of, I'd always fit the format of this like rock and roll trio thing. And everything I did was sort of more in this rock and roll vein. You know, so, I mean, I felt like kept true to that, but, you know, this was an opportunity for me to kind of spread my wings and sing and focus on the vocals, you know, channel some of the singers that I grew up loving, you know, like we did Nina Simone.
If I stay, I know that I'm a sailor.
I did not realize that Van McCoy wrote that song. I was just assuming Nina wrote all of her stuff,
but that was her. You know, I loved her version of that song, and that was one of the most challenging ones to record because she is such a unique. I mean, everything she does is just. I mean, she's incomparable. So, you know, to go in and into the studio and do one a song in the style of her was like it was quite a feat. So, you know, I just try to take a little inspiration and make it my own.
Have you come to some of these songs recently, or did you, like I said, did you grow up with some of these songs?
Some of them, but, you know, a lot of this was me and my producer, Bobby Harlow, shoot stuff back and forth material. You know, like, he introduced me to some of these obscure girl groups, like the Cinemas, Never Gonna Cry. We just kind of shot stuff back and forth. You know, we recorded Crow Jane in the style. Well, you know, I took the inspiration from Skip James, but we sort of adopted it to the North Mississippi stuff that I really like.
Crow Jane, Crow Jane, don't you hold your head too high, 'cause someday, babe, you know you gotta die.
You know, so there's my stuff on there, you know, and he brought me some songs, and we kind of just picked the best of what we could. You know, really, the criteria was, like, I wanted it to sound like a hit. And so did Bobby. You know, these hooks had to be powerful and strong, and everything had to really feel bigger.
Well, our guest is singer-songwriter Samantha Fish. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Most of, if not all of these, were hit songs in some fashion. Many of them have been sort of forgotten. How did you envision producing them?
Well, you know, we met up with a band, well, members of this band called the Detroit Cobras. The rhythm section was comprised there. I mean, we had Joe Mazzola on guitar, and we brought in a keyboard player and a horn section from New Orleans. So really, it was like just recording this in a bigger fashion, having horn parts and this big, dramatic, dynamic band.
It's your voodoo working. It's your voodoo working. Voodoo working. Now can I get a little...
You know, not all the songs are Motown. We recorded in Detroit, but it was like we wanted everything to kind of fit together and be a cohesive album. So, you know, anything that sort of fit the personality of this band. But a lot of that, you know, that just kind of happens in the studio. It's the chemistry and the magic that you have with the people in the studio and the moments that you're in. So, you know, we just kind of shaped them in there.
You recorded Hello Stranger, the song Barbara Lewis was noted for. And this is an interesting song in itself because the name of the song is the very first couple of words in the song, and then it doesn't appear anywhere else in the song.
Yeah, I know.
Hello, stranger.
It's a great tune. I mean, I was probably most scared of that one because if you listen to the original, it's got all these like, bop, bop, my baby. And I didn't know how I was going to pull that off, you know. But we ended up just sort of adopting it and making it a little, I guess, modernizing it a little bit. We had the horn section play, you know, the old vocal lines and put a really hip drum beat to it. Yeah, I mean, that ended up being one of my favorite on the record. It's such a cool, cool sound and a really interesting groove. So.
Seems like a long time.
to why you went in this direction in the first place. You wanted to stretch out a little bit. But if you really want to make it in the music business or even stay in the music, you sort of have to stretch out a little bit, don't you?
I think so. You know, and people will... They'll complain when you stretch out, and they complain when you stay the same, too, you know. So it's been one of those interesting shifts that, like, you know, some people were scared of us going to this bigger band and changing the sound a little bit. But, you know, I feel like it pays off because it keeps me inspired and keeps me working and moving. And I feel like that's really, you know, if you're doing that, you're constantly challenging yourself to grow, you're going to come up with better and better stuff. And it's only going to benefit the music. So, yeah.
How do you feel you have become a better player or a more rounded person just by doing this album?
Absolutely. I mean, it stretched my singing chops out. You know, I get the opportunity to, like, really take my time, and I'm still playing just as much guitar now, but it's, you know, I'm not splitting my brain in half trying to focus so hard on these rhythms and then sing, you know. Singing becomes a secondary part to the guitar. You know, now it's like, I feel like they're a little more evenly matched. You know, that's helped a lot. And then, you know, playing off of another melodic instrument in the band, I've only ever been me in a rhythm section. So, you know, now I got horns and they play a line and I can kind of listen to them and play off of that. It just gives me more to work with. And it's really fun, you know.
Samantha Fish, great to talk with you. Congratulations on your most recent album, Chills and Fever.
Thank you.
Samantha Fish plays the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. Doors open at 7 with Brett Button. You can hear songs from Fish's new album on GLT's Blues Radio at WGLT.org. Find all of our music reporting with the GLT Music Podcast at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and Ryan Denham. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.